Hey everyone, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library podcast. Thanks for joining us. This is episode number 24. On this show, we connect you with the brightest minds in the commercial real estate industry, from founders of the largest REITs in Canada to chief city planners for metropolitan areas across the nation. We're really excited to share this episode with you. It touches on an important issue right now, housing affordability. And so we are joined by Daniel Gare. He is the Chief Development Officer at Options for Homes. Options for Homes is a private nonprofit developer that's been facilitating home ownership through down payment assistance for over 25 years. It's an extremely interesting model, actually one that the government has now began to replicate, speaking to the successful nature of it. Before we dive in, I want to give a quick thank you to our sponsor, KMB Law. KMB Law are corporate real estate lawyers that specialize in the acquisition, disposition, and financing of commercial real estate. Check them out. We find them to be extremely reliable. KMBLaw.com, KMBLaw.com. I also want to say thank you to Mizrahi Developments. Mizrahi Developments was founded with the principle of changing expectations in the development industry. They do that on every one of their projects. And speaking of projects that they're doing, the one they are building at the southwest corner of Bloor and Yonge, currently the tallest building under construction. So check them out, MizrahiDevelopments.ca. Support us by supporting them and enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library. I'm Dama Tamanawala. You know my co-host, Garrett McGilvery. And today we're joined by Daniel Gare from Options for Homes.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So before we dive into your background, can you tell us a little bit about Options for Homes and what makes you guys different as a developer?
Yeah, for sure. So Options is a nonprofit developer. We're entirely focused on ownership housing. So we only build affordable ownership housing. And do you want me to describe the whole model just for?
So
the way the model works is, as a developer, we source and acquire land and take it through the planning and approvals process. We market and sell all the units ourselves, and what we, in the end, just like any other developer, we create value through the development cycle. So what the world refers to as profit, we call surplus. But what we do is we make that surplus available to purchasers as part of their down payment. So the whole premise of the organization is to get people into ownership housing that otherwise couldn't or couldn't today. So our purchasers are people that can afford to live in a home. They can afford to pay a mortgage, property taxes, all the cost of owning a home, but they're challenged by being able to save up enough for down payment in the market that we're in. Actually, I mean, the organization's been around for 25 years, so I guess they've always been challenged, our type of purchasers.
Right. Now more than ever.
Now more than ever. Yeah.
So how does that surplus work? Like, how does it work for you to make it more affordable for the end purchaser?
Well, in essence, so it's a second mortgage. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it's invested alongside the purchaser. So that capital or that mortgage doesn't require any debt service. So the owner doesn't have to pay principal or interest on that loan. Mm-hmm. So we call it a silent second mortgage, meaning that it just sort of sits there silently. So that purchaser would have otherwise been getting a 95% loan, which would be more expensive than the loan that they have to get by living in our buildings with our 15% loan.
Okay, so you give them a 0% second mortgage, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any tax consequences for that?
For them or no? To be honest, I don't think so. Ours is called a shared appreciation loan.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's 0% interest. But what happens is, in the end, whenever someone decides to move out, to sell their unit, Or at really at any point they choose, the loan is repaid to us and we share in the appreciation. So what that means is if we lend them 15%, we would receive 15% of the appreciation.
Okay. So it's like pseudo equity at that point.
It's truly treated like equity in that we also share in the downside risk. So if the unit were to be devalued, our loan would also be devalued.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the important thing though is that as a nonprofit, that money, whatever growth happens, is reinvested back into the next development.
Yeah.
So it always stays in the pod, and it's always reinvested back into future developments.
Okay. And do you see any parallels with the new CMHC program that's coming out, that they're kind of doing a bit of the similar thing?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I don't want to say it's our model, but it's very, very close to our model. And Heather Tremaine, our CEO, was consulted significantly in the design of this. So I, it's a very similar model, and I guess the federal government recognizes that it's a easy way to help people get into the ownership market.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And for those who don't know the program, can you describe it a little bit?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So it's a 10% loan. So the federal government has made available for first-time homeowners up to 10% of the value of the purchase. Under certain circumstances. So it's not, to be honest, it's actually not perfect for Toronto, because I don't think most real estate in Toronto will qualify for it, because they have a cap in terms of the multiple on income and the value of the property, which, you know, in the city, most of the property around here exceeds what their limit is. So it's designed for the entire country. It's not specifically for Toronto, but it functions the same way. It's a shared appreciation loan.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's a cap on income too, which a lot of households would have greater than, I think, 120,000 in Toronto.
And I think 120 is the cap.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay. So can we talk a little bit about some of your projects? So Options for Homes, you have a new project in Milton. I was just up there. Where are you guys building these developments, and where does it work? Where does the model, where's the model great?
So we're, so traditionally Options for Homes focus mainly in Toronto. There's been developments all over Ontario, some outside of sort of the GTA, but a lot of the volume of production has been in Toronto. We do have some projects outside. So the Milton project is occupied. It's going to close in the next couple months. And so that's complete. We have a project on the west end of Toronto at Lawrence and Weston Road called the Humber, which has just gone into construction. We have a large project that we actually purchased from the city through from CreateTO in Scarborough at Markham Road in Eglinton. And we're also redeveloping
the... When did you buy that?
We closed on that at the end of last year. So it's a very interesting project. It's two towers and about 200 stacked townhomes.
Okay.
And we're actually doing that in partnership with Habitat for Humanity. They have a block of townhomes in there. So yeah, it's a very interesting project. The city has funded up to 300 units of affordable housing on that through their development charge program. And we're going to deliver our model. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how, and I'd like to take a few steps back and talk about your background, because obviously the whole company, as well as you as the chief development officer, are very mission driven.
Yeah.
Because you could be working at, I guess Tridel is one of your partners, but you could be working at Tridel or Monkeys or one of these groups, right?
Right.
But how does that, how does the model, I still don't fully understand, like, how do you make the numbers work? I had a client who was trying to develop affordable housing up in Richmond Hill, and they had a CMHC loan for, I think, it was something insane, like 1.5%. They were going to, CMHC said that they could finance it at that rate. And still the numbers didn't work to construct rental housing. This was rental.
Right.
So, like, do you find that you can still pay competitive prices for land? You know, is it that the government is more lenient on what you guys can build in the end? Like, how does it all work?
So the first part of your question was sort of my background, how I ended up, I think, in this. But what I do want to sort of say is the reason that I chose to be at Options is that this business model is one of the only sustainable affordable housing business models that I've seen, which was very, very attractive to me. So it functions at market. It works in any market. It works without any government support. When other things come into play, it helps because it helps to create a bigger surplus, which means more down payment available for end users. But the whole model is premised on paying, functioning in the market at market. Because as long as it underwrites correctly and pencils out with an appropriate margin that's financeable and viable, there's a surplus. You can't really do this without creating a margin. And as long as there's a margin, that money is available as down payment assistance to our end users. So to answer your question, yeah, we pay for land. We pay the same as everybody else.
Same as any developer.
The same as any developer. I mean, obviously we choose the markets we want to be in to make sure that in the end, so for instance, I probably wouldn't go pay $250 a foot buildable for an end unit that's going to sell at $2,000 a foot, because what does that really do?
Right.
What does our 15% down payment do? Mm-hmm. Right? So area matters, geography matters, but it functions with or without support from the government. Any dollar we get extra, so in the case of that Markham Road and Eglinton site where we have development charge deferrals on a portion of that unit, that's layered on top of our second mortgage. So we're going to throw in our capital, then we'll layer on top the city capital. So instead of giving a 15% second mortgage, we'll give a 20 or 25% second mortgage, therefore driving down the income that can afford to buy a home there. Right. So it just becomes more affordable. You know, if you layer on provincial funding, if you layer on federal funding, if you get the land for free, all these things increase that surplus, and we can just pass that back on to the end user.
And when you do pencil projects, do you specifically pencil in profit so that every unit in your building can receive the sort of 15%?
Absolutely. Program? So yeah, like we underwrite these at market.
Yeah.
And it has to be, because that's what our lenders would look for.
Yeah.
We finance it conventionally, so it has to be viable like any other for-profit development effectively.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, in essence, if we didn't do that, we'd be paying too much for something, right?
Yes. So. No, 100%.
Yeah.
Is your clientele different at all? Like, for instance, the absorption rate for some of these condo is it similar to, or is it faster than a traditional condo project?
No, I would say it's slower. So, and a few things affect that. So, for one, we only sell to end users. So there's no...
Right.
So our intent is to never sell to an investor. Mm-hmm. We want the building full of end users. We want the product to go in the right hands of the people that it's intended to go to. So right away, you can imagine what that would do to absorption in the city of Toronto, given who the typical buyer is right now.
Right.
So like in our agreements of purchase and sale, purchasers sign an affidavit stating that they're an end user. Our mortgages, that second mortgage, has certain default clauses if the units are rented out. So there's structure in place to ensure that this is not ending up in the hands of the wrong person. But because of that, the typical marketing and sales channels don't necessarily penetrate to get to that end user as fast or as easily. So we have to do it differently, and it takes longer.
Right.
And we have to budget that.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, because you shared in the appreciation of the property itself, and that happens after, obviously it gets triggered after people start selling the units, is that where your main source of capital ends up being? It's just sort of the rollover of new units, because then you get more capital, then you can buy more land, and then you can develop more buildings. Is that sort of the...
Yeah, so it's probably important to know a little bit about our structure. So Options for Homes is a development consultant or development manager.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have our sister company called Home Ownership Alternatives, and that's our fund. That's where the mortgages reside, and that's where our capital is,
mm-hmm.
the capital we use to develop. And then there's the development site itself, which is yet another entity. It's actually a cooperative. It's structured as a co-op. Mm-hmm. So Options for Homes receives its revenue through development management fees. It's a modest fee that pays our overhead, our basically salaries, rent, blah, blah, blah. So it's a management fee. But the actual capital for future development comes from the repayment of mortgages and its appropriate appreciation, and then it's then reinvested back into housing.
And just on that program itself, aside from not giving it to investors, are there any other limitations on it, like income thresholds or anything like that, or is it just has to be end users, that's it?
So it kind of depends. So when it's only Options creating the program, we are less limiting than when for instance, government is contributing. So it depends on the program that the purchaser is tapping into. So in our case, we don't limit income for a few reasons. We believe that, for one, by design, if someone had the income to go buy a unit at market, they probably wouldn't buy ours because they're giving up a share of the appreciation. So the structure of it sort of limits people. It removes people that wouldn't normally want to. Why would they buy with us? Doesn't make any sense, right? So that kind of right away by design gets us to the right purchaser. But we decided not to limit income because our view is you don't really know what's going on in any one person's life. Income's not the only thing that affects life affordability. It could be a variety of things. So we wanted to keep it less stringent. When you do layer on things like the city funding or provincial or federal funding, they have their own requirements. And if a purchaser wanted to stack that, we'd have to make sure it qualifies for all the other programs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you ever have people say no to your program and just have 5% and then CMHC up to the 95?
Yeah. Like
what, there are, and still want a condo unit?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like there are people that opt not to take our mortgage. We're 100% fine with that. Like, this is, again, a nonprofit. We're not looking specifically to generate growth of those mortgages. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, typical business wisdom says just give it back as soon as possible so we can go reinvest it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is not our MO, to just place mortgages and make them grow at extreme amounts. So if someone doesn't need it, but they still love the project and they want to live in it, yeah, maybe they put more than 5% down. Maybe they put 10 or 15 and not take such a large mortgage. You know? Okay. And that happens. Like, we have great projects. It's built by an amazing builder, and they're generally in areas that people like. So if they like it, they like it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
How many units have you built so far? Been 25 years, right?
Yeah. 3,500 roughly.
Wow.
And
that's a lot.
We have now in the pipeline probably 1,500 to 2,000 units, depending on what we get approved.
Right.
What I want to count and what.
Is the government more supportive of you as a developer? Like, you know, do you see that the timelines are slightly shorter? Are they more
on approvals?
When it comes to the height, you know, the density restrictions. Hey guys, I want to say a quick thank you to our sponsor, Green Fox Capital. Green Fox Capital specializes in structured debt and equity placements for commercial real estate. They provide strategic financing for the largest names in commercial real estate when it comes to commercial property and land acquisitions. Over the last few years, the team at Green Fox has completed over $2 billion worth of placements and built a reputation around strategic guidance of their clients. If you're looking for sharper interest rates, a higher loan to value, or better terms, go to greenfoxcapital.com and hit the request to call back button, and a member of their team will reach out to you right away. Again, that's Green Fox Capital. Green like the color, fox like the animal, capital like Ottawa. .com, greenfoxcapital.com. Check them out. Also, if you happen to be a real estate broker and you refer one of your deals, these guys take excellent care of your clients and deliver quite large referral fees. So check them out. Ask them about that. We certainly love these guys. greenfoxcapital.com. Thanks. Back to the podcast. Is there a substantial difference?
I would, like, it depends on the municipality you're in.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is that, you know, municipalities like Toronto and the planning departments, many of them want to be as helpful as possible. And it's just that there's so many applications in that they can only go so fast. So we have great relationships with the city, both at the political level and the bureaucratic level. People try to be as helpful as they can. It doesn't necessarily translate to speed.
Right.
And, you know, it's a highly regulated business, and it's so complex. And so even if the municipality was to say, yeah, we'll push this thing forward, then you run into things like the TRCA that have other complications that you have to work through, environmental matters, water issues. Like, there's so many things that can affect the timing of a development that, unfortunately, it doesn't really translate into being faster despite people's best efforts. You know, my personal experience, even outside of options, is it tends to be faster when you're in smaller towns when there's less development applications, really is what it means. But it's, you know, we kind of suffer through the same way anyone else does.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Do you guys receive any special incentives like waivers on tax or development charges or anything like that?
No. So, well, again, it depends on where you are. But in Toronto, last year when the DC bylaw was reviewed, council passed a development charge deferral program for home ownership units. And you have to apply for those. I believe there's an allocation of 400 units per year. So as a project comes online, we'll apply.
Mm-hmm. And 400 units across the whole city?
For affordable nonprofit home ownership units.
Okay.
So we could end up in a competitive time where other nonprofit affordable developers are going for the same thing.
Right. So
we'll see how. Right now it's actually working quite well. So the Humber at Western Road Lawrence received 6.6 million. So that's on 147 units. That project at Markham Road in Eglinton has 300 units on it. And every time we have a development, we'll apply for the program. I mean, it's helpful, right?
Right.
Is there a lot of nonprofit developers out there, or are you guys sort of one of the few?
No.
There's two words don't even mesh together, nonprofit developer.
I know. It's kind of weird, eh?
Yeah.
So I'm like, 100% you get the 400, I'm like, that's not a lot, but if you're getting them on every project, I'm like, are you guys alone?
No,
you're the biggest.
Yeah.
I think we're probably the biggest in terms of volume of output, but there are others. So Habitat for Humanity, as an example, is a nonprofit affordable ownership developer, and they absolutely would go after these, well-deserved, to get the same program. There's a group called Trillium Housing that does the same kind of model. Artscape has done it. I don't know how active they are now in the ownership side, but they would definitely go for it. So, yeah, there's a few people. There's a few groups that are doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you guys are building and designing the building, does it differ substantially from a traditional building in the way that you, like, are you trying to make it in a way that's more cost effective? You know, how is your building different than a traditional Tridel building, for instance?
So, I mean, fundamentally, to the end user, you won't really know it from the outside at all. It's a phenomenally built Delterra product that you or I wouldn't know the difference, really. Mm-hmm. When you get in, you also really won't see much different. What you will see is a more modest lobby, as an example. When you get into the amenity space, you'll see a significant reduction from what the luxury condo market's building. So you won't find, fully built out gyms. You won't find swimming pools. You won't find things that drive up both capital costs and ongoing operating costs, because those are the two things we're trying to manage. Mm-hmm. In the units themselves, again, like, beautifully appointed, very, very tasteful, but you won't see a base finishing package with granite countertops and Wolf ovens, right? You'll see a more modest package we have upgrades available. But we, you know, that's one of the areas that we'll spend quite a bit of time on, making them totally livable, beautiful, but tasteful and modest.
Right.
Right.
And so, then at the end of the day, low condo fees.
Yeah. So condo fees are a big thing, as everyone knows, right? Like, I mean, we're probably sitting in the low 50 cents a foot. And, you know, it's pretty typical for a lot of the new buildings to be a dollar, you know, like. It's a big difference, and that adds up on 1,000 square feet, you know, or 800 square feet a month, right? So,
question in regards to back to the mortgage thing.
Yeah.
What happens if somebody uses your 0% mortgage, but then they go into difficulties of is paying that A mortgage, and they can't keep up payments? Do you guys take over, or what happens?
So, I guess for one thing, it's unbelievably rare. So before I came here today, I did look into this because I was just curious.
Yeah.
So of the 3,500 units, I think there's been 7 owners that had any financial problems with their first mortgage lender. So the way we control that is we do a ton of work on the front end when finding a purchaser.
Mm-hmm.
So typically purchasers will be fully pre-approved prior to even walking in our sales office. We have relationships with 3 major institutions, Meridian, Bank of Montreal, and CIBC, that know our program, and they do a different type of approval for mortgage purposes, where they go pretty deep. It's a fully underwritten loan, and basically committed years in advance, which most, as you know, in the new construction world, that's not really how it works. So there's a ton of work that goes on the front end to make sure that the purchaser is capable of closing and owning this home. But we have sort of another filter, I'd say, is that, so that sister company I was talking about, Home Ownership Alternatives, they're a mortgage broker, amongst other things. So that group, when a purchaser buys from us, they also go to see Home Ownership Alternatives, and they go through yet another sort of round of underwriting to make sure that we're not putting anyone under undue pressure and selling someone a unit that wouldn't be appropriate for them to buy.
Okay. And do you guys have a similar deposit structure like other condos? Because like some of them go up to like 20% or 15%, I think.
We do not. So 5% is due upon purchase, basically, or within 30 days of purchasing. And that's it. So from a lend, so our contribution is viewed as deposits. So from a purchasing standpoint, effectively, if someone uses our contribution, they do have 20% down.
Okay.
Just by virtue of what we bring to the table.
Okay. I get that. Yeah. All right. That makes sense. Because they're using the mortgage payment as the, that they would eventually give on the unit as the other.
As the other part of the down payment.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. And that's critical. And that only works because we have great relationships with CMHC. We go in through a program called Flexibilities that recognizes our second mortgage as equity for the purpose of borrowing a first mortgage, which is another thing that adds to affordability, because that means when a purchaser goes to get a first mortgage, there's no CMHC insurance on that. It's a conventional first mortgage.
Okay. Right. A little more broadly speaking, what are your thoughts on sort of like the condo market in Toronto? Like, is there a place for younger individuals that are coming up like us to even buy condos and stuff like that? Because like prices are going up. Even with programs such as yours, you still have to pay like $4,000 a month in a mortgage cost or something like that for anything downtown. So that's other than the size of this room.
Yeah. No, look, it's a crazy time in Toronto. It's a very, very difficult time from a pricing standpoint. I hope that our program gets big enough that we really do fill that gap where you know, we are creating that entry point into the ownership market, because really, you know, the term affordable housing has connotations that, you know, we are, that's really not what we're doing. We're not creating low income housing. We're not creating subsidized housing. We're creating market housing that is more affordable than what's on the market right now to help people get into it. But there's only so far we can go, right? Like the market that, the dynamics of the market around us is driving everything up. So is there an end in sight? It's hard to see. I think we can all assume there is, because that's how, you know, economic cycles work, but it's hard to see.
Yeah. We're still going to probably be like New York City here in Toronto.
Probably.
In terms of pricing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other markets though, the surrounding markets that are well connected by transit are obviously going to be the places that people move out to.
For sure. But even still, places like Oakville, you have $1 million home type of thing. It's like, oh, easy. I can have $1 million home or like actually live downtown Toronto.
Yeah. No, it's not
easy. I feel like Oshawa would be a little more affordable out east type of thing.
No, but, you know, I don't know. Kitchener, Waterloo, Guelph, Milton, Hamilton, you know, it does work. Look, our project at the Humber is quite a bit less expensive than the market right now.
Yeah.
Right.
How much are you?
I think we're at, we're at about 700 a foot right now, 750, if I recall the and we're at the very end of our inventory, 'cause we've passed our presale threshold. So like for in absolute dollars, you can still get a pretty nice size 2-bedroom plus den for, you know, $500,000, which is really hard to get in Toronto. And that, you know, it's on the it's slightly outside of sort of where all the development activity is, but that's minutes from the UP Express. You can get down here very quickly, I think 15, 20 minutes. So that kind of a product does work for first-time owners.
And somebody just needs $25,000 to make that happen.
And hopefully a lot of people at this point have saved up a bit into RRSPs, and you can access that through your first-time homeowner program.
Right.
So you can get into it.
Are you guys going to eventually maybe be pushed out of the Toronto market because your model might not work when, you know, say the minimum price ends up being like $1,500 a foot for any type of condo unit within, obviously, the surrounding Toronto area?
So, you know, we're obviously aware of these dynamics and what does this model work 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Mm-hmm. And I guess the key here is that we are always having to innovate, always having to figure out, okay, that's an aspect we don't control. So what else has to happen here? So, like, I guess a good example is the Housing Now sites that are on the market right now through the City of Toronto. You know, when government's motivated to create supply, that makes it easier because, A, in the case of Housing Now, they've de-risked these. These are being sold zoned. So the timeline to get them out into market is much more compressed and therefore less expensive in the end. You know, the province has released land where they've basically given the land before as an incentive to create affordable housing. So I think that we have to assume that we will eventually need quite a bit of extra support for this model to work perfectly.
Can you speak to why it's so important to own a home, for instance? Like, a lot of the discussion in Toronto is around affordable places to rent, even in just living situations.
I mean, there's a lot there. So I don't want to come off saying that good cities need everything. You need options. You need plenty of rental, which we have basically none of, and you need ownership opportunities. People need places to live. Ownership has a variety of benefits. So from an end user perspective, I think just security of tenure is a big thing.
Right.
You know, I know a lot of friends and family that live in rental housing and are constantly worried that, you know, this landlord is eventually going to say, hey, you're paying 50 cents on the dollar for what I could get. Let me find a loophole to get you out of here. Like, that does happen all over the place.
I'm gonna are you a rental?
No. Are you a renter? Okay, no. So you don't suffer through this, but people do. Like, this is a thing that exists right now, and it's very unfortunate. So I think the sense of security is a big deal. Pride of ownership is also a big deal. Like, if you were to see our developments, you would see a building that's run really, really well because everyone cares. This is their asset. This is where they live, and they care. But then there's obviously all the other benefits of owning a home. You have an asset. It's appreciating. That's something that will help your kids. It can help. You can finance it to put your kids through university. It could eventually become part of your retirement plan. So there's all the other benefits of just owning real estate as an investment. And then the other thing that we always try to remind, really everybody, especially government, is that the benefit of creating a new unit of ownership, especially affordable ownership, is you've also relieved pressure on the rental side of the equation because we're moving people out of rental into our product. So you're creating almost two units of available supply every time we bring on a new unit of ownership.
That makes sense. Quickly pushing back something before, how do you vet that they're not investors? And have you ever had people like skirt under whatever type of controls that you put on top of that?
I mean, there's only so much we could do, but we do a lot. So we do spend a lot of time one-on-one with our sales team spends a lot of time getting to know who they are, first and foremost. We'll often search title.
Yeah.
So the brokerage, the second mortgage, home ownership alternatives, will often look into, okay, who are these people? Do they own four homes? Like,
have they done this already?
They already have an option.
What makes up? Because they're looking at them for borrowing capacity, so they want to know, do you have assets?
Right.
So, you know, and then, like I said, also, like, people are putting themselves on the line. They are signing a binding agreement and an affidavit that is enforceable, stating that they're not an investor. So we do everything we can, but, you know, does an investor sneak through? Probably, but we would hope not.
That's the same issue that conventional financing has too, right? Like I was just on the phone with the mortgage broker you hooked me up with.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay, what if I want to buy it at the rate of living in it? And then I'll just put tenants in there and use it as an investment property. And he said, okay, well, you can't tell me that because that's fraud. So I think they go through the same thing, but you know,
he's a very straight and narrow guy, by the way. So.
Right. Right.
He's very on the level.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
So you might want somebody else to commit those types of mortgage
venture in with me. Okay. One thing, so we didn't really get too far into this, but I do find it really interesting how mission driven you are personally and as a company.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got on this trajectory?
Sure. So I grew up in a real estate family. My father is an active developer. My grandfather was a developer. So I kind of grew up in the business. I worked with my family for about a decade, primarily building retirement housing, a little bit of hotel stuff, but mostly in the retirement housing business.
Right.
And I, at one point, I sort of had the idea that I really like social enterprise. Like, I just like the idea of a really good business model that also allows other benefits outside of just profit. So I actually started looking at businesses outside of real estate in general. Like, I just liked social enterprise businesses in general. And the long story short is this. I was playing a game of squash. I play squash, and I was playing in a squash ladder, and I got teamed up with someone who's now a friend of mine, but he's from the Daniels Corporation. And we were talking, and he flagged that Habitat for Humanity Greater Toronto Area was looking for like a head of development, a VP of development. So I went and met with Habitat at the time. I really didn't know much about affordable housing other than a rental project I worked on, but I was just intrigued. I was intrigued that this kind of product can be produced in Toronto and has such an impactful outcome to the end user and to society as a whole. That it just seemed so interesting that I went to Habitat. So about 4 years ago, I ended up at Habitat, and that's really where I got into this, is trying to find a way to build housing in the GTA that's affordable. So I liked it a lot, and then I worked on this joint venture with Options for Homes and Habitat at the Scarborough site I was describing, and that's how I got to know Options, and you know, an opportunity showed up at Options. So I like it. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And when you're at Habitat, you're doing similar thing?
Yeah, very similar.
Okay.
Very similar. I mean, Habitat's slightly different because they go for an end user that's significantly lower income than I think what Options is attracting.
Mm-hmm.
They have a different mortgage structure at Habitat that allows it to attract or to serve people of lower income. And that's their mission. So it was slightly different. It was also a low-rise producer, so almost exclusively at Habitat. So, you know, when I was there, I was working on a site in Scarborough. It was 50 units of stacked townhomes. And it's also a business model based on volunteers helping to actually construct. So it's very different than working with Delterra. I would hope they don't use volunteers. So it's just a different environment. What I do now at Options is the mission is very much grounded in affordable ownership housing, but it's my day-to-day is much more like when I was building with my family commercial real estate high-rise development.
Mm-hmm.
So
what is the future of better question, what's the future of Options for Homes? What are you guys up to? Are you expanding into different markets? Are you going, right now you're just in the GTA, right?
Yeah, I mean, it expands slightly past, like, we have a really large site in Guelph that we're working through right now. But yeah, like, the boundary is sort of GTA, GTHA. We don't have, like, a geographic boundary, you know, by law or anything. Like, I think we can go into different markets. And we talk about it. We're interested. We do look for opportunities if they arise, but like, our infrastructure's here. It's not that easy to just go into another market, and you know, chiefly because we don't necessarily have the same construction contacts in other markets, or just general suppliers. Like we very often use the same sort of architects, engineers, appraisers, like everybody. We have a team that we know quite well here, and we have a really deep relationship with Delterra. So it does kind of anchor us here. But I think, to your point before, like, will Toronto always be the place for this? I think that's probably what's going to drive us to look to other markets more than anything, is where can we be the most impactful? Mm-hmm. Where does our program work really, really well? And where is there clear demand for our program? I think will be the thing in the future that would drive us to look in other markets, not just because. Like, it would have to be a mission-driven reason, and there would have to be opportunities and a way for us to execute, you know, with lower risk. So, mm-hmm.
If you had a magic wand,
yeah,
say you were...
I do.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you have it with you?
No. No. My 5-year-old kept it.
That's dangerous.
Yeah.
if you had a magic wand and you could, you know, wave it and create any policy change that you wanted, you know, what would you do if you're Premier Ford, if you're Greg Lintern, Chief City Planner, what would you do to create a better environment for affordable housing?
Or Justin Trudeau, you know, he went up the chain. So.
Okay.
look, there's not one thing, right?
Right.
Like, there just isn't one thing. I think the time it takes to get through the approvals is very, very hard.
Yeah.
And the amount of risk that you can't predict and you don't know exists is very difficult to work in. So can Greg Lintern solve this? I don't think it's a magic wand issue, but
right.
If I were to pick anything, I'd say speed the whole thing up, you know, period. Like, yeah. Just speed it up.
That's interesting. So that's the biggest problem for you, and also the guys building these, you know, at Yonge and Eglinton or wherever, right? Luxury condominiums.
Well, how else do you manage? How do you manage this? How do you manage, you know, you buy a site today. I'm not going to go to market for 2 years. I don't actually know what I'm going to sell it. So maybe it worked today.
At least 2 years.
Yeah. Maybe I looked at it today and said, great, this is an affordable housing project. But when I actually go to market, the market's appreciated so much. Yeah, is it still the same intent, right?
Yeah.
And in that 2 years, construction costs have also gone up by 10-11% a year, whatever we're going up at. New policy has come on, you know, that makes it harder. Like, there's so much that happens in that period in time that drives up costs, drives up, you know, the value, and it kind of just takes away from the point. Like right now, you know, Mayor Tory said when he was elected he wants to produce 40,000 units. In his terms, 4 years, it's a 4-year term.
Right. 40,000 housing units,
yeah.
Not rental units.
Don't quote me on this, but it is rental units, okay. I'm pretty sure. But in any event, like, that's a lot of supply in a very short amount of time. And the city's actually doing what they can to do it through the Housing Now program, mm-hmm. by taking through the approvals process faster than the market can. But how do you bring on enough supply to meet demand in a short, like, the supply-demand equation will continue to get worse. Like, I don't really know how you can do it fast unless policy steps in to change that, to shift it. So I think that would be the magic wand.
Great.
But I feel like it's difficult because, like, obviously Toronto has probably the most cranes than any other city in America or in the world. Or in the world or something like that, I think it was right now. And that's tough.
Definitely North
That's
America.
Tough on planners because, like, everybody's developing basically everything. I can see two cranes right now. Maybe a third right – yeah, third one right there. And that's just, like, a teeny little quadrant of Toronto. It's like, that's tough.
Right.
I feel like that would be really tough on Greg. That's probably why he went back to work after we had the interview with him. Right. At, like, 7 o'clock at night. Yeah. He's just like, all right.
This is what I'm saying. Like, everyone is working hard.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not because people aren't doing their job. It's just that it's a complicated business. It's a complicated world to be in.
Right.
Yeah. Sean, do you have any questions?
Yeah. Got one question. You guys took the good ones, but I'll throw something in there. At Real Trends, when we met.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking a little bit about some of the barriers and options for homeless facing, including the stigma for affordable housing. and then you sort of compared it to what people think of it as the prototypical CMHC definition of 30%, whatever, and whatever that comes with, whatever quality of product that comes with. But what is Options for Home sort of doing from a marketing perspective, from a development perspective, to sort of jump that barrier or let people know, hey, this is affordable housing, but not the way you may perceive it to be or think it to be.
So I don't remember saying any of that, but I do believe you. So where that comes into play is often during the approvals, dealing with community, right? Community engagement and the potential stigma that the neighborhood may feel we're bringing it down. Right. Like it's not, and I went through this at Habitat too. It's quite normal for if we're doing an infill project in a neighborhood for, you know, the neighbors to say, oh, you're building subsidized housing. This is low income housing. You're going to bring crime and prostitution and everything else in our neighborhood and devalue our homes. And that's a branding issue that's greater than just options. That's just differentiating, I think, affordable housing from housing affordability. And that's something we constantly have to work at. We constantly have to work with stakeholders in the surrounding area for them to understand what it is we build. Fortunately, it does get easier when we do have a track record. We have a great builder. So people tend to start to feel a little more calm about the kind of product we're building, and you can go see any one of our projects and no one would ever say, oh, that's a, you know, crime filled building. Like just right. it's not the case, but that is an issue that, I mean, any developer goes up against sort of the NIMBYism, but for, unfortunately, I think affordable housing developers get it worse. So that is a problem that I think we have to fix with just really good communication strategies, really, really good community engagement strategies.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. You want to do your last question, Dima?
Sure. So this question, it's not on there, but it's called The Three Truths. So.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You should have brought your magic wand.
It's not so bad. Okay. Years from now, you live a long and successful life, and you accomplish everything that you ever wanted to accomplish. Beyond your wildest dreams. And but it's your last day. And all of the people that love you are around you and your family and friends. But for whatever reason, every interview that you've ever done, every book that you've ever written, it's all been erased. And you have three short notes to write to pass on to the people who love you and your colleagues and whoever. What would you put on those notes? Words of wisdom.
Can it's be a brutal about, question.
Can be about it. Can be about development. It could be about right. the way to your philosophy for life. Anything.
So for reference, Greg Lintern said, "Get lots of sleep." That was one of his truths.
So I mean, I could answer this dishonestly, which could be funny, but I think that if you're really asking this, I think that the truth is that you need to just be honest, respectful, and have integrity. Like that is it, right? So if you can live a life with that as your MO, like I think you'll be pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Get more sleep is probably a good one too.
Right. We've also had get less sleep.
Yeah. No, I don't know if I could get any less sleep. So
yeah. Oh, you know. Okay. Can't give that advice. Yeah. Then. Yeah.
So.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. For you? That's good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Daniel.